2. Roland, Eddie, and Susanna had heard most of Jake's tale. Jake and Susanna had heard most of Roland's and Eddie's. Now Callahan got both, what he later called the double feature. He listened with his eyes wide and his mouth frequently agape. He crossed himself when Jake told of hiding in the closet. To Eddie, the pair said, "You didn't mean it about killing the wives and children, of course. That was just a bluff." Eddie looked up at the heavy sky, considering this with a faint smile. Then he looked back at Callahan. "Roland tells me that for a guy who doesn't want to be called father, you've taken some very fatherly stands just lately. If you're speaking about the idea of terminating your wife's pregnancy," Eddie raised a hand, "let's say I'm not speaking of any one thing in particular. It's just that we've got a job to do here, and we need you to help us do it. The last thing we need is to get sidetracked by a lot of your old Catholic blather, so let's just say yes, I was bluffing and move on. Will that serve, Father?" Eddie's smile had grown strained and exasperated. There were bright smudges of color on his cheekbones. Callahan considered the look of him with great care and then nodded. "Yes," he said, "you were bluffing. By all means, let's leave it at that and move on." "Good," Eddie said. He looked at Roland.
"The first question is for Susanna," Roland said. "It's a simple one. How are you feeling?"
"Just fine," she replied.
"Say true?"
She nodded.
"Say true, say thank you."
"No headaches here?"
Roland rubbed above his left temple.
"No.
And the jittery feelings I used to get just after sunset, just before dawn, have quit. And look at me." She ran a hand down the swell of her breasts, to her waist, to her right hip. "I've lost some of the fullness. Roland, I've read that sometimes animals in the wild, carnivores like wildcats, herbivores like deer and rabbits, reabsorb their babies if the conditions to have them are adverse. You don't suppose—" She trailed off, looking at him hopefully. Roland wished he could have supported this charming idea, but he couldn't. And withholding the truth within the quartet was no longer an option. He shook his head. Susanna's face fell.
"She's been sleeping quietly, so far as I can tell," Eddie said. "No sign of Mia."
"Rosalita says the same," Callahan added.
"You got that Jane watching me,"
Susanna said in a suspiciously Detta-like tone, but she was smiling.
"Every now and then," Callahan admitted.
"Let's leave the subject of Susanna's chap, if we may," Roland said. "We need to speak of the wolves. Them, and little else."
"But Roland—"
Eddie began. Roland held up his hand.
"I know how many other matters there are. I know how pressing they are. I also know that if we become distracted, we're apt to die here in Calabrin Sturgis. And dead gunslingers can help no one. Nor do they go their course. Do you agree?" His eyes swept them. No one replied. Somewhere in the distance was the sound of many children singing. The sound was high and gleeful and innocent. Something about Kamala.
"There is one other bit of business that we must address," Roland said. "It involves you, Pear, and what's now called the Doorway Cave. Will you go through that door and back to your country?"
"Are you kidding?" Callahan's eyes were bright. "A chance to go back, even for a little while? You just say the word."
Roland nodded. "Later today, mayhap you and I will take a little passeer on up there. And I'll see you through the door. You know where the vacant lot is, don't you?"
"Sure. I must have been past it 1,000 times back in my other life. And you understand about the zip code?"
Eddie asked.
"If Mr. Tower did as you requested, it'll be written at the end of the board fence, 46th Street side. That was brilliant, by the way."
"Get the number. And get the date, too," Roland said. "We have to keep track of the time over there if we can. Eddie's right about that. Get it and come back. Then, after the meeting in the pavilion, we'll need you to go through the door again."
"This time to wherever Tower and Deepno are in New England," Callahan guessed.
"Yes," Roland said.
"If you find them, you'll want to talk mostly to Mr. Deepno.
Jake said. He flushed when they all turned to him, but kept his eyes trained on Callahan's.
Mr. Tower might be stubborn.
That's the understatement of the century, Eddie said. By the time you get there, he'll probably have found 12 used bookstores and God knows how many first editions of Indiana Jones's 19th Nervous Breakdown.
But Mr. Deepnow will listen, Jake went on.
It's an ache,
Oi said, and rolled over onto his back.
It's an quiet.
Scratching Oi's belly, Jake said, If anyone can convince Mr. Tower to do something, it'll be Mr. Deepnow.
Okay, Callahan replied, nodding. I hear you well.
The singing children were closer now. Susanna turned, but couldn't see them yet. She assumed they were coming up River Street. If so, they'd be in view once they cleared the livery and turned down the high street at Took's general store. Some of the folk on the porch over there were already getting up to look. Roland, meanwhile, was studying Eddie with a small smile.
Once, when I used the word assume, you told me a saying about it from your world. I'd hear it again if you remember. Eddie grinned.
Assume makes an ass out of you and me. Is that the one you mean?
Roland nodded.
It's a good saying. All the same, I'm going to make an assumption now, pound it like a nail, and hang all our hopes of coming out of this alive on it. I don't like it, but see no choice. The assumption is that only Ben Sleitman and Andy are working against us. That if we take care of them when the time comes, we can move in secrecy.
Don't kill him,
Jake said, in a voice almost too low to hear. He had drawn Oi close and was petting the top of his head and his long neck with a kind of compulsive, darting speed. Oi bore this patiently.
Cry pardon, Jake, Susanna said, leaning forward and tipping a hand behind one ear. I didn't...
Don't kill him.
This time his voice was hoarse and wavering and close to tears.
Don't kill Benny's dad, please.
Eddie reached out and cupped the nape of the boy's neck gently.
Jake, Benny Sleitman's dad is willing to send 100 kids off into Thunderclap with the wolves just to spare his own. And you know how they'd come back.
Yeah, but in his eyes, he doesn't have any choice because...
His choice could have been to stand with us,
Roland said. His voice was dull and dreadful, almost dead.
But
what? Jake didn't know. He had been over this and over this, and he still didn't know. Sudden tears spilled from his eyes and ran down his cheeks. Callahan reached out to touch him. Jake pushed his hand away.
Roland sighed. We'll do what we can to spare him. That much I promise you. I don't know if it'll be a mercy or not. The Sleitmans are going to be through in this town, if there's a town left after the end of next week. But perhaps they'll go north or south along the Crescent and start some sort of new life. And Jake, listen, there's no need for Ben Sleitman to ever know you overheard Andy and his father last night. Jake was looking at him with an expression that didn't quite dare to be hope. He didn't care a hill of beans about Sleitman the Elder, but he didn't want Benny to know it was him. He supposed that made him a coward, but he didn't want Benny to know.
Really? For sure?
Nothing about this is for sure, but before he could finish, the singing children swept around the corner, leading them, silver limbs and golden body gleaming mellowly in the day's subdued light. Was Andy the messenger robot? He was walking backward. In one hand was a bob bolt wrapped in banners of bright silk. To Susanna, he looked like a parade marshal on the 4th of July. He waved his baton extravagantly from side to side, leading the children in their song while a reedy bagpipe accompaniment issued from the speakers in his chest and head.
Holy shit, Eddie said. It's the Pied Piper of Hamelin.
3.
Kamala, come one, mama had a son, that's a time a daddy had the most fun.
Andy sang this part alone, then pointed his baton at the crowd of children. They joined in boisterously.
Kamala, come, come, daddy had one, that's a time that mommy had the most fun.
Gleeful laughter. There weren't as many kids as Susanna would have thought, given the amount of noise they were putting out. Seeing Andy there at their head after hearing Jake's story chilled her heart.
At the same time, she felt an angry pulse begin to beat in her throat and her left temple. That he should lead them down the street like this, like the Pied Piper. Eddie was right, like the Pied Piper of Hamelin. Now he pointed his makeshift baton at a pretty girl who looked 13 or 14. Susanna thought she was one of the Anselm kids from the small hole just south of T. and Jaffords's place. She sang out the next verse bright and clear to that same heavily rhythmic beat, which was almost, but not quite, a skip-rope chant.
"Kamala, come too. You know what to do. Plant the rice, Kamala. Don't you be no fool."
Then, as the others joined in again, Susanna realized that the group of children was bigger than she'd thought when they came around the corner, quite a bit bigger. Her ears had told her truer than her eyes, and there was a perfectly good reason for that.
"Kamala, come too," they sang. "Daddy no foo. Mommy plant Kamala 'cause she know just what to do."
The group looked smaller at first glance because so many of the faces were the same. The face of the Anselm girl, for instance, was nearly the face of the boy next to her, her twin brother. Almost all the kids in Andy's group were twins. Susanna suddenly realized how eerie this was, like all the strange doublings they'd encountered caught in a bottle. Her stomach turned over, and she felt the first twinge of pain above her left eye. Her hand began to rise toward the tender spot.
"No," she told herself, "I don't feel that."
She made the hand go back down. There was no need to rub her brow, no need to rub what didn't hurt. Andy pointed his baton at a strutting, pudgy little boy who couldn't have been more than 8. He sang the words out in a high and childish treble that made the other kids laugh.
"Kamala, come tree. You know what to be. Plant the rice, Kamala, and the rice'll make you free."
To which the chorus replied,
"Kamala, come tree. Rice'll make you free. When you plant the rice, Kamala, you know just what to be."
Andy saw Roland's quartet and waved his baton cheerily. So did the children, half of whom would come back drooling and ruined if the parade marshal had his way. They would grow to the size of giants, screaming with pain, and then die early. "Wave back," Roland said, and raised his hand. "Wave back, all of you, for the sake of your fathers." Eddie flashed Andy a happy, toothy grin.
"How you doing, you cheapshit Radio Shack dickweed?"
he asked. The voice coming through his grin was low and savage. He gave Andy a double thumbs up.
"How you doing, you robot psycho? Say fine. Say thank you. Say bite my bag."
Jake burst out laughing at that. They all continued waving and smiling. The children waved and smiled back. Andy also waved. He led his merry band down the high street, chanting "Kamala come four, Rivers at the door."
"They love him," Callahan said.
There was a strange, sick expression of disgust on his face.
"Generations of children have loved Andy."
"That," Roland remarked, "is about to change." 4. "Further questions?" Roland asked when Andy and the children were gone. "Ask now, if you will. It could be your last chance."
"What about T. and Jaffords?" Callahan asked. "In a very real sense, it was Tian who started this. There ought to be a place for him at the finish."
Roland nodded. "I have a job for him. One he and Eddie will do together. Pair that's a fine privy down below Rosalita's cottage. Tall. Strong."
Callahan raised his eyebrows.
"Aye, say thank you. 'Twas Tian and his neighbor Hugh Anselm who built it."
"Could you put a lock on the outside of it in the next few days?"
"I could, but—"
"If things go well, no lock will be necessary, but one can never be sure."
"No," Callahan said, "I suppose one can't. But I can do as you ask."
"What's your plan, sugar?"
Susanna asked. She spoke in a quiet, oddly gentle voice.
"There's precious little plan in it. Most times that's all to the good. The most important thing I can tell you is not to believe anything I say once we get up from here, dust off our bottoms, and rejoin the Falcon. Especially nothing I say when I stand up at the meeting with the feather in my hand. Most of it'll be lies."
He gave them a smile. Above it, his faded blue eyes were as hard as rocks.
"My Da and Cuthbert's Da used to have a rule between 'em. First the smiles. then the lies. Last comes gunfire.
We're almost there, aren't we? Susanna asked. Almost to the shooting.
Roland nodded, and the shooting will happen so fast and be over so quick that you'll wonder what all the planning and palaver was for, when in the end it always comes down to the same 5 minutes' worth of blood, pain, and stupidity. He paused, then said, I always feel sick afterward. Like I did when Bert and I went to see the hanged man.
I have a question,
Jake said. Ask it, Roland told him.
Will we win?
Roland was quiet for such a long time that Susanna began to be afraid. Then he said, we know more than they think we know. Far more. They've grown complacent. If Andy and Sleitman are the only rats in the woodpile, and if there aren't too many in the wolf pack, if we don't run out of plates and cartridges, then yes, Jake, son of Elmer, we'll win.
How many is too many?
Roland considered, his faded blue eyes looking east. More than you'd believe, he said at last, and I hope many more than they would. 5. Late that afternoon, Donald Callahan stood in front of the unfound door, trying to concentrate on Second Avenue in the year 1977. What he fixed upon was Choo Choo Mama's and how sometimes he and George and Lupe Delgado would go there for lunch.
I ate the beef brisket whenever I could get it, Callahan said,
and tried to ignore the shrieking voice of his mother rising from the cave's dark belly. When he'd first come in with Roland, his eyes had been drawn to the books Calvin Tower had sent through. So many books! Callahan's mostly generous heart grew greedy and a bit smaller at the sight of them. His interest didn't last, however, just long enough to pull one at random and see it was The Virginian by Owen Wister. It was hard to browse when your dead friends and loved ones were shrieking at you and calling you names. His mother was currently asking him why he had allowed a vampire, a filthy bloodsucker, to break the cross she had given him.
You was always weak in faith, she said dolorously. Weak in the faith and strong for the drink. I bet you'd like one right now, wouldn't you?
Dear God, would he ever. Whiskey. Ancient age. Callahan felt sweat break on his forehead. His heart was beating double time. No, triple time.
The brisket, he muttered, with some of that brown mustard splashed on top of it.
He could even see the plastic squeeze bottle the mustard came in, and remember the brand name, Plachman's.
What?
Roland asked from behind him.
I said I'm ready, Callahan said. If you're going to do it, for God's love, do it now.
Roland cracked open the box. The chimes at once bolted through Callahan's ears, making him remember the low men in their loud cars. His stomach shriveled inside his belly, and outraged tears burst from his eyes. But the door clicked open, and a wedge of bright sunshine slanted through, dispelling the gloom of the cave's mouth. Callahan took a deep breath and thought, "Oh, Mary, conceived without sin, pray for us who have recourse to thee," and stepped into the summer of 77. 6. It was noon, of course. Lunchtime. And of course he was standing in front of Choo Choo Mama's. No one seemed to notice his arrival. The chalked specials on the easel just outside the restaurant door read, "Hey you, welcome to Choo Choo. Specials for June 24th. Beef stroganoff, beef brisket with cabbage, Rancho Grande tacos, chicken soup. Try our Dutch apple pie." All right, one question was answered. It was the day after Eddie had come here. As for the next one, Callahan put 46th Street at his back for the time being and walked up 2nd Avenue. Once he looked behind him and saw the doorway to the cave following him as faithfully as the Billy Bumbler followed the boy. He could see Roland sitting there, putting something in his ears to block the maddening tinkle of the chimes. He got exactly 2 blocks before stopping, his eyes growing wide with shock, his mouth dropping open. They had said to expect this, both Roland and Eddie, but in his heart, Callahan hadn't believed it.
He'd thought he would find the Manhattan Restaurant of the Mind perfectly intact on this perfect summer's day, which was so different from the overcast Kala autumn he'd left. Oh, there might be a sign in the window, reading "Gone on Vacation, Closed Until August," something like that. But it would be there, oh yes. It wasn't, though. At least not much of it. The storefront was a burnt-out husk, surrounded by yellow tape reading "Police Investigation." When he stepped a little closer, he could smell charred lumber, burnt paper, and, very faint, the odor of gasoline. An elderly shoeshine boy had set up shop in front of station shoes and boots nearby. Now he said to Callahan, "Shame, ain't it? Thank God the place was empty." "Aye, say thank you. When did it happen?" "Middle of the night, when else? You think them goombars is going to come throw their molly cocktails in broad daylight? They ain't geniuses, but they're smarter than that. Couldn't it have been faulty wiring, or maybe spontaneous combustion?" The elderly shine boy gave Callahan a cynical look. "Aw, please," it said. He cocked a polish-smeared thumb at the smoldering ruin. "You see that yellow tape? You think they put yellow tape, says, police investigation, around a place that's spontaneously combustulated? No way, my friend. No way, Jose. Cal Tower was in hock to the bad boys up to his eyebrows. Everybody on the block knew it." The shine boy waggled his own eyebrows, which were lush and white and tangled. "I hate to think about his loss. He had some very valuable books in the back there, very valuable." Callahan thanked the shine boy for his insights, then turned and started back down Second Avenue. He kept touching himself furtively, trying to convince himself that this was really happening. He kept taking deep breaths of the city air with its tang of hydrocarbons and relished every city sound, from the snore of the buses — there were ads for Charlie's Angels on some of them — to the pounding of the jackhammers and the incessant honking of horns. As he approached Tower of Power Records, he paused for a moment, transfixed by the music pouring from the speakers over the doors. It was an oldie he hadn't heard in years, one that had been popular way back in his Lowell days. Something about following the Pied Piper. "Crispin St. Peters," he murmured. "That was his name. Good God, same man, Jesus, I'm really here. I'm really in New York." As if to confirm this, a harried-sounding woman said, "Maybe some people can stand around all day, but some of us are walking here. Think yous could move it along, or at least get over to the side?" Callahan spoke an apology, which he doubted was heard, or appreciated if it was, and moved along. That sense of being in a dream, an extraordinarily vivid dream, persisted until he neared 46th Street. Then he began to hear the rose, and everything in his life changed. 7. At first, it was little more than a murmur, but as he drew closer, he thought he could hear many voices, angelic voices, singing, raising their confident, joyful psalms to God. He had never heard anything so sweet, and he began to run. He came to the fence and laid his hands against it. He began to weep, couldn't help it. He supposed people were looking at him, but he didn't care. He suddenly understood a great deal about Roland and his friends, and for the first time felt a part of them. No wonder they were trying so hard to survive and to go on. No wonder, when this was at stake. There was something on the other side of this fence with its tattered overlay of posters, something so utterly and completely wonderful. A young man, with his long hair held back in a rubber band and wearing a tipped-back cowboy hat, stopped and clapped him briefly on the shoulder.
"It's nice here, isn't it?" the hippie cowboy said. "I don't know just why, but it really is. I come once a day. You want to know something?"
Callahan turned toward the young man, wiping at his streaming eyes.
"Yes, I guess so."
The young man brushed a hand across his brow, then his cheek.
"I used to have the world's worst acne. I mean, pizza face wasn't even in it. I was roadkill face. Then I started coming here in late March or early April, and everything cleared up."
The young man laughed.
The dermo guy my dad sent me to says it's the zinc oxide, but I think it's this place. Something about this place. Do you hear it?
Although Callahan's voice was ringing with sweetly singing voices, it was like being in Notre Dame Cathedral and surrounded by choirs. He shook his head. Doing so was nothing more than instinct.
Nah, said the hippie in the cowboy hat. Me neither. But sometimes I think I do.
He raised his right hand to Callahan, the first two fingers extended in a V.
Peace, brother?
Peace, Callahan said, and returned the sign. When the hippie cowboy was gone, Callahan ran his hand across the splintery boards of the fence and a tattered poster advertising War of the Zombies. What he wanted more than anything was to climb over and see the rose, possibly to fall on his knees and adore it. But the sidewalks were packed with people, and already he had attracted too many curious looks. Some, no doubt, from people who, like the hippie cowboy, knew a bit about the power of this place. He would best serve the great and singing force behind this fence. Was it a rose? Could it be no more than that? By protecting it. And that meant protecting Calvin Tower from whoever had burned down his store. Still trailing his hand along the rough boards, he turned onto 46th Street. Down at the end on this side was the glassy green bulk of the UN Plaza Hotel. Kala Callahan, he thought, and then Kala Callahan Calvin. And then Kala come four, there's a rose behind the door. Kala come Callahan, Calvin's one more. He reached the end of the fence. At first he saw nothing, and his heart sank. Then he looked down, and there it was. At knee height, five numbers written in black. Callahan reached into his pocket for the stub of pencil he always kept there, then pulled off a corner of a poster for an off-Broadway play called Dungeon Plunger, a review. On this, he scribbled five numbers. He didn't want to leave, but knew he had to. Clear thinking this close to the rose was impossible.
I'll be back, he told it, and to his delighted amazement, a thought came back, clear and true.
Yes, Father, any time. Come, Kamala. On the corner of 2nd and 46th, he looked behind him. The door to the cave was still there, the bottom floating about 3 inches off the sidewalk. A middle-aged couple, tourists judging by the guidebooks in their hands, came walking up from the direction of the hotel. Chatting to each other, they reached the door and swerved around it. They don't see it, but they feel it, Callahan thought. And if the sidewalk had been crowded and swerving had been impossible? He thought in that case they would have walked right through the place where it hung and shimmered, perhaps feeling nothing but a momentary coldness and sense of vertigo. Perhaps hearing faintly the sour tang of chimes and catching a whiff of something like burnt onions or seared meat. And that night, perhaps, they'd have transient dreams of places far stranger than Fun City. He could step back through, probably should. He'd gotten what he'd come for. But a brisk walk would take him to the New York Public Library. There, behind the stone lions, even a man with no money in his pocket could get a little information. The location of a certain zip code, for instance. And, tell the truth and shame the devil, he didn't want to leave just yet. He waved his hands in front of him until the gunslinger noticed what he was doing. Ignoring the looks of the passers-by, Callahan raised his fingers in the air once, twice, three times, not sure the gunslinger would get it. Roland seemed to. He gave an exaggerated nod, then thumbs up for good measure. Callahan set off, walking so fast he was nearly jogging. It wouldn't do to linger, no matter how pleasant a change New York made. It couldn't be pleasant where Roland was waiting. And according to Eddie, it might be dangerous as well. 8. The gunslinger had no problem understanding Callahan's message. 30 fingers, 30 minutes. The pair wanted another half an hour on the other side. Roland surmised he had thought of a way to turn the number written on the fence into an actual place. If he could do that, it would be all to the good. Information was power. And sometimes, when time was tight, it was speed. The bullets in his ears blocked the voices completely. The chimes got in, but even they were dulled. a good thing because the sound of them was far worse than the warble of the finny. A couple of days listening to that sound, and he reckoned he'd be ready for the lunatic asylum. But for 30 minutes he'd be all right. If worse came to worst, he might be able to pitch something through the door, attract the pair's attention, and get him to come back early. For a little while, Roland watched the street unroll before Callahan. The doors on the beach had been like looking through the eyes of his three, Eddie, Odetta, Jack Mort. This one was a little different. He could always see Callahan's back in it, or his face if he turned around to look, as he often did. To pass the time, Roland got up to look at a few of the books which had meant so much to Calvin Tower that he'd made their safety a condition for his cooperation. The first one Roland pulled out had the silhouette of a man's head on it. The man was smoking a pipe and wearing a sort of gamekeeper's hat. Court had had one like it, and as a boy, Roland had thought it much more stylish than his father's old day rider with its sweat stains and frayed tug string. The words on the book were of the New York world. Roland was sure he could have read them easily if he'd been on that side, but he wasn't. As it was, he could read some, and the result was almost as maddening as the chimes.
"Sherlock Holmes," he read aloud. "No, Holmes, like Odetta's father name. 4 short Movels." Movels? No, this one was an N. 4 short novels by Sherlock Holmes.
He opened the book, running a respectful hand over the title page and then smelling it. The spicy, faintly sweet aroma of good old paper. He could make out the name of one of the 4 short novels, The Sign of the 4. Other than the words hound and study, the titles of the others were gibberish to him.
"A sign is a sigil," he said. When he found himself counting the number of letters in the title, he had to laugh at himself. Besides, there were only 16.
He put the book back and took up another, this one with a drawing of a soldier on the front. He could make out one word of the title, dead. He looked at another. A man and woman kissing on the cover. Yes, there were always men and women kissing in stories. Folks liked that. He put it back and looked up to check on Callahan's progress. His eyes widened slightly as he saw the pair walking into a great room filled with books and what Eddie called Magda scenes. Although Roland was still unsure what Magda had seen or why there should be so much written about it. He pulled out another book and smiled at the picture on the cover. There was a church with the sun going down red behind it. The church looked a bit like Our Lady of Serenity. He opened it and thumbed through it. A delah of words, but he could only make out one in every 3, if that. No pictures. He was about to put it back when something caught his eye, leaped at his eye. Roland stopped breathing for a moment. He stood back, no longer hearing the Todash chimes, no longer caring about the great room of books Callahan had entered. He began reading the book with a church on the front, or trying to. The words swam maddeningly in front of his eyes, and he couldn't be sure, not quite, but gods, if he was seeing what he thought he was seeing. Intuition told him that this was a key, but to what door? He didn't know. Couldn't read enough of the words to know, but the book in his hands seemed almost to thrum. Roland thought that perhaps this book was like the rose. But there were black roses, too. 9.
"Roland, I found it. It's a little town in central Maine called East Stoneham, about 40 miles north of Portland, and—"
He stopped, getting a good look at the gunslinger.
"What's wrong?"
"The chiming sound," Roland said quickly. "Even with my ears stopped up, it got through." The door was shut and the chimes were gone, but there were still the voices. Callahan's father was currently asking if Donnie thought those magazines he'd found under his son's bed were anything a Christian boy would want to have. What if his mother had found them? And when Roland suggested they leave the cave, Callahan was more than willing to go. He remembered that conversation with his old man far too clearly. They had ended up praying together at the foot of his bed, and the 3 playboys had gone into the incinerator out back. Roland returned the carved box to the pink bag and once more stowed it carefully behind Tower's case of valuable books. He had already replaced the book with the church on it, turning it with the title down so he could find it again quickly. They went out and stood side by side, taking deep breaths of the fresh air.
"Are you sure the chimes is all it was?" Callahan asked.
"Man, you looked as though you'd seen a ghost."
"The Todash chimes are worse than ghosts," Roland said. That might or might not be true, but it seemed to satisfy Callahan. As they started down the path, Roland remembered the promise he had made to the others, and more important, to himself. No more secrets within the Tet. How quickly he found himself ready to break that promise. But he felt he was right to do so. He knew at least some of the names in that book. The others would know them too. Later they would need to know if the book was as important as he thought it might be. But now it would only distract them from the approaching business of the wolves. If they could win that battle, then perhaps...
"Roland, are you quite sure you're okay?"
"Yes." He clapped Callahan on the shoulder. The others would be able to read the book, and by reading might discover what it meant. Perhaps the story in the book was just a story. But how could it be when... "Pear?"
"Yes, Roland."
"A novel is a story, isn't it? A made-up story?"
"Yes, a long one."
"But make-believe."
"Yes, that's what fiction means, make-believe."
Roland pondered this. Charlie the Choo-Choo had also been make-believe, only in many ways, many vital ways, it hadn't been. And the author's name had changed. There were many different worlds, all held together by the tower. Maybe... No, not now. He mustn't think about these things now. "Tell me about the town where Tower and his friend went," Roland said.
"I can't, really. I found it in one of the main telephone books, that's all. Also, a simplified zip code map that showed about where it is."
"Good, that's very good.
Roland, are you sure you're all right?"
"Kala," Roland thought. "Callahan." He made himself smile. Made himself clap Callahan on the shoulder again. "I'm fine," he said. "Now let's get back to town."
Chapter 5 The Meeting of the Falcon 1 Tian Jaffords had never been more frightened in his life than he was as he stood on the stage in the pavilion, looking down at the Falcon of Calabrin Sturgis. He knew there were likely no more than 500. 600 at the very outside, but to him it looked like a multitude. And their taut silence was unnerving. He looked at his wife for comfort, and found none there. Zelia's face looked thin and dark and pinched, the face of an old woman rather than one still well within her childbearing years. Nor did the look of this late afternoon help him find calm. Overhead the sky was a pellucid, cloudless blue, but it was too dark for 5 o'clock. There was a huge bank of clouds in the southwest, and the sun had passed behind them just as he climbed the steps to the stage. It was what his grandpere would have called weirding weather. Omenish, say thank you. In the constant darkness that was Thunderclap, lightning flashed like great sparklights. "Had I known it would come to this, I'd never have started it a-going," he thought wildly. "And this time there'll be no Pear Callahan to haul my poor old ashes out of the fire." Although Callahan was there, standing with Roland and his friends, they of the hard calibers, with his arms folded on his plain black shirt with the notched collar and his man Jesus' cross hanging above. He told himself not to be foolish, that Callahan would help and the outworlders would help as well. They were there to help. The code they followed demanded that they must help, even if it meant their destruction and the end of whatever quest they were on. He told himself that all he needed to do was introduce Roland, and Roland would come. Once before, the gunslinger had stood on this stage and danced the Kamala and won their hearts. Did Tian doubt that Roland would win their hearts again? In truth, Tian did not. What he was afraid of in his heart was that this time it would be a death dance instead of a life dance.
because death was what this man and his friends were about. It was their bread and wine. It was the sherbet they took to clear their palates when the meal was done. At that first meeting, could it have been less than a month ago? Tian had spoken out of angry desperation, but a month was long enough to count the cost. What if this was a mistake? What if the wolves burned the entire Kala flat with their light sticks, took the children they wanted one final time, and exploded all the ones that were left, old, young, in the middle, with their whizzing balls of death? They stood waiting for him to begin. The gathered Kala. Eisenharts and Overholzers and Javiers and Tooks, without number, although no twins among these last, of the age the wolves liked, I know. Such lucky Tooks they were. Telford standing with the men and his plump but hard-faced wife with the women. Strongs and Rossiters and Slightmans and Hands and Rosarios and Pocellas. The Manny once again bunched together like a dark stain of ink. Henchik, their patriarch, standing with young Cantab, whom all the children liked so well. Andy, another favorite of the kiddies, standing off to one side with his skinny metal arms akimbo and his blue electric eyes flashing in the gloom. The sisters of Oriza bunched together like birds on fence wire, Tien's wife among them, and the cowboys, the hired men, the day boys, even old Bernardo, the town tosspot. To Tien's right, those who had carried the feather shuffled a bit uneasily. In ordinary circumstances, one set of twins was plenty to take the Apopanax feather. In most cases, people knew well in advance what was up, and carrying the feather was nothing but a formality. This time, it had been Margaret Eisenhart's idea, three sets of twins had gone together with the hallowed feather, carrying it from town to smallhold, to ranch, to farm, in a bucca driven by Cantab, who sat unusually silent and songless up front, clucking along a matched set of brown mules that needed precious little help from the likes of him. Oldest at 23 were the Hagengood twins, born the year of the last wolf raid, and ugly as sin by the lights of most folks, although precious hard workers say thank you. Next came the Tavery twins, those beautiful map-drawing town brats. Last, and youngest, although eldest of Tien's brood, came Hedden and Hedda. And it was Hedda who got him going. Tien caught her eye, and saw that his good, although plain-faced, daughter had sensed her father's fright, and was on the verge of tears herself. Eddie and Jake weren't the only ones who heard the voices of others in their heads. Tien now heard the voice of his grandpere. Not as Jamie was now, doddering and nearly toothless, but as he had been 20 years before. Old, but still capable of clouting you over the river road if you sassed back or dawdled over a hard pull. Jamie Jaffords, who had once stood against the wolves, this Tien had from time to time doubted. But he doubted it no longer, because Roland believed.
"Garn, then," snarled the voice in his mind. "What is it, fashes and diddles thee, so slow, o' thing? 'Tis nubber to say his name and stand aside, ain't it? Then, for good on this, you can let him do a rest."
Still Tien looked out over the silent crowd a moment longer. Their bulk hemmed in tonight by torches that didn't change, for this was no party, but only glared a steady orange. Because he wanted to say something, perhaps needed to say something. If only to acknowledge that he was partly to credit for this. For good or for nis. In the eastern darkness, lightning fired off silent explosions. Roland, standing with his arms folded like the pair, caught Tien's eye and nodded slightly to him. Even by warm torchlight, the gunslinger's blue gaze was cold, almost as cold as Andy's. Yet it was all the encouragement Tien needed. He took the feather and held it before him. Even the crowd's breathing seemed to still. Somewhere far over town, a rusty cawed as if to hold back the night.
"Not long since I stood in yon gathering hall and told thee what I believe," Tien said. "That when the wolves come, they don't just take our children, but our hearts and souls. Each time they steal and we stand by, they cut us a little deeper. If you cut a tree deep enough, it dies. Cut a town deep enough, that dies too."
The voice of Rosalita Munoz, childless her whole life, rang out in the fey dimness of the day with clear ferocity.
Say true, say thank you, hear him, folk, and hear him very well.
Hear him, hear him, hear him well, ran through the assembly.
Pear stood up that night and told us there were gunslingers coming from the northwest, coming through mid-forest along the path of the beam. Some scoffed, but Pear spoke true.
Say thank you, they replied. Pear said true.
And a woman's voice,
praise Jesus, praise Mary, Mother of God.
They've been among us all these days since. Any who's wanted to speak to them has spoke to them. They have promised nothing but to help.
And a move on, leaving bloody ruin behind him, if we're foolish enough to allow it,
Eben Took roared. There was a shocked gasp from the crowd. As it died, Wayne Overholzer said,
Shut up, you great mouth organ!
Took turned to look at Overholzer, the Kala's big farmer and Took's best customer, with a look of gaping surprise.
Tien said, Their din is Roland de Shane of Gilead.
They knew this, but the mention of such legendary names still provoked a low, almost moaning murmur.
From in-world that was, would you hear him? What say you, Folkin?
Their response quickly rose to a shout. Hear him, hear him, we would hear him to the last, hear him well, say thank you. And a soft, rhythmic, crumping sound that Tien could not at first identify. Then he realized what it was and almost smiled. This was what the tromping of shore boots sounded like, not on the boards of the gathering hall, but out here on Lady Rise's grass. Tien held out his hand. Roland came forward. The tromping sound grew louder as he did. Women were joining in, doing the best they could in their soft town shoes. Roland mounted the steps. Tien gave him the feather and left the stage, taking Hedda's hand and motioning for the rest of the twins to go before him. Roland stood with the feather held before him, gripping its ancient lacquered stalk with hands now bearing only 8 digits. At last, the tromping of the shoes and shore boots died away. The torches sizzled and spat, illuminating the upturned faces of the Falcon, showing their hope and fear, showing both very well. The rusty called and was still. In the east, big lightning sliced up the darkness. The gunslinger stood facing them. 2. For what seemed a very long time, looking was all he did. In each glazed and frightened eye he read the same thing. He had seen it many times before, and it was easy reading. These people were hungry. They'd fain buy something to eat, fill their restless bellies. He remembered the pieman who walked the streets of Gilead Lowtown in the hottest days of summer, and how his mother had called him Sepisai on account of how sick such pies could make people. Sepisai meant the death cellar. Aye, he thought, but I and my friends don't charge. At this thought, his face lit in a smile. It rolled years off his craggy map, and a sigh of nervous relief came from the crowd. He started as he had before.
We are well met in Akala. Hear me, I beg.
Silence.
You have opened to us. We have opened to you, is it not so?
Aye, gunslinger,
Von Eisenhardt called back.
Tis.
Do you see us for what we are, and accept what we do?
It was Henchik of the Manny who answered this time.
Aye, Roland, by the book, and say thank you. Ye are availed. White come to stand against black.
This time the crowd's sigh was long. Somewhere near the back, a woman began to sob.
Kala Folkin, do you seek aid and succor of us?
Eddie stiffened. This question had been asked of many individuals during their weeks in Kala Bryn Sturgis, but he thought to ask it here was extremely risky. What if they said no? A moment later, Eddie realized he needn't have worried. In sizing up his audience, Roland was as shrewd as ever. Some did in fact say no, a smattering of Haycoxes, a peck of Tooks, and a small cluster of Telfords led the antis. But most of the Falcon roared out a hearty and immediate, Aye, say thank you. A few others, Overholzer was the most prominent, said nothing either way. Eddie thought that in most cases this would have been the wisest move. The most politic move, anyway. But this wasn't most cases. It was the most extraordinary moment of choice most of these people would ever face. If the Quartet of 19 won against the Wolves, the people of this town would remember those who said no and those who said nothing. He wondered idly if Wayne Dale Overholzer would still be the big farmer in these parts a year from now. But then Roland opened the palaver, and Eddie turned his entire attention toward him, his admiring attention. Growing up where and how he had, Eddie had heard plenty of lies, had told plenty himself, some of them very good ones. But by the time Roland reached the middle of his spiel, Eddie realized he had never been in the presence of a true genius of mendacity until this early evening in Calibrin Sturgis. And Eddie looked around, then nodded, satisfied. And they were swallowing every word. 3. "Last time I was on this stage before you," Roland began, "I danced the Kamala. Tonight—" George Telford interrupted. He was too oily for Eddie's taste, and too sly by half, but he couldn't fault the man's courage, speaking up as he did when the tide was so clearly running in the other direction.
"Aye, we remember, ye danced it well. How dance ye the mortata, Roland? Tell me that, I beg."
Disapproving murmurs from the crowd. "Doesn't matter how I dance it," Roland said, not in the least discommoded, "for my dancing days in the Kala are done. We have work in this town, I and mine. Ye've made us welcome, and we say thank you. Ye've bid us on, sought our aid and succor, so now I bid ye to listen very well. In less of a week come the Wolves." There was a sigh of agreement. Time might have grown slippery, but even Lofoken could still hold on to 5 days' worth of it. "On the night before they're due, I'd have every Kala twin child under the age of 17 there," Roland pointed off to the left, where the Sisters of Ariza had put up a tent. Tonight there were a good many children in there, although by no means the 100 or so at risk. The older had been given the task of tending the younger for the duration of the meeting, and one or another of the sisters periodically checked to make sure all was yet fine.
"That tent won't hold them all, Roland," Ben Sleitman said.
Roland smiled. "But a bigger one will, Ben, and I reckon the sisters can find one."
"Aye, and give them a meal they won't ever forget,"
Margaret Eisenhart called out bravely. Good-natured laughter greeted this, then sputtered before it caught. Many in the crowd were no doubt reflecting that if the Wolves won after all, half the children who spent Wolf's Eve on the green wouldn't be able to remember their own names a week or two later, let alone what they'd eaten.
"I'd sleep 'em here so we can get an early start the next morning," Roland said. "From all I've been told, there's no way to know if the Wolves will come early, late, or in the middle of the day. We'd look the fools of the world if they were to come extra early and catch 'em right here in the open."
"What's to keep 'em from coming a day early?"
Eben Took called out truculently.
"Or at midnight on what you call Wolf's Eve?"
"They can't," Roland said simply. And, based on Jamie Jaffords's testimony, they were almost positive this was true. The old man's story was his reason for letting Andy and Ben Sleitman run free for the next 5 days and nights. "They come from afar, and not all their traveling is on horseback. Their schedule is fixed far in advance."
"How do you know?"
Lewis Haycox asked.
"Better I not tell," Roland said. "Mayhap the Wolves have long ears."
A considering silence met this. "On the same night, Wolf's Eve, I'd have a dozen bucka wagons here, the biggest in the Kala, to draw the children out to the north of town. I'll appoint the drivers. There'll also be childminders to go with them and stay with them when the time comes, and you needn't ask me where they'll be going. It's best we not speak of that either." Of course, most of them thought they already knew where the children would be taken. The Old Gloria. Word had a way of getting around, as Roland well knew. Ben Sleitman had thought a little further, to the Redbird too, south of the Gloria, and that was also fine.
George Telford cried out,
"Don't listen to this, Falcon, I beg you, and even if you do listen, for your souls and the life of this town, don't do it. What he's saying is madness. We've tried to hide our children before, and it doesn't work. But even if it did, they'd surely come and burn this town for vengeance sake, burn it flat."
"Silence, you coward." It was Henchik, his voice as dry as a whipcrack. Telford would have said more regardless, but his eldest son took his arm and made him stop. It was just as well. The clumping of the shore boots had begun again. Telford looked at Eisenhart unbelievingly, his thought as clear as a shout. "You can't mean to be part of this madness, can you?" The big rancher shook his head.
"No point looking at me so, George. I stand with my wife, and she stands with the eld."
Applause greeted this. Roland waited for it to quiet. "Rancher Telford says true. The wolves likely will know where the children have been bunkered, and when they come, my quartet will be there to greet them. It won't be the first time we've stood against such as they." Roars of approval. More soft clumping of boots, some rhythmic applause. Telford and Eben Took looked about with wide eyes, like men discovering they had awakened in a lunatic asylum. When the pavilion was quiet again, Roland said, "Some from town have agreed to stand with us. Folka with good weapons. Again, it's not a thing you need to know about just now. But of course the feminine construction told those who didn't already know about the Sisters of Oryza a great deal. Eddie once more had to marvel at the way he was leading them. Cozy wasn't in it. He glanced at Susanna, who rolled her eyes and gave him a smile. But the hand she put on his arm was cold. She wanted this to be over. Eddie knew exactly how she felt. Telford tried one last time.
"People, hear me. All this has been tried before."
It was Jake Chambers who spoke up.
"It hasn't been tried by gunslingers," sighed Telford.
A fierce roar of approval met this. There was more stamping and clapping. Roland finally had to raise his hands to quiet it. "Most of the wolves will go to where they think the children are, and we'll deal with them there," he said. "Smaller groups may indeed raid the farms or ranches. Some may come into town. And aye, there may be some burning." They listened silently and respectfully, nodding, arriving ahead of him to the next point, as he had wanted them to. A burned building can be replaced. A ruined child cannot.
"Aye," said Rosalita, "nor a ruined heart."
There were murmurs of agreement, mostly from the women. In Calabrin Sturgis, as in most other places, men in a state of sobriety did not much like to talk about their hearts. "Hear me now, for I tell you at least this much more. We know exactly what these wolves are. Jamie Jaffords has told us what we already suspected." There were murmurs of surprise. Heads turned. Jamie, standing beside his grandson, managed to straighten his curved back for a moment or two and actually puff up his sunken chest. Eddie only hoped the old buzzard would hold his peace over what came next. If he got muddled and contradicted the tale Roland was about to tell, their job would become much harder. At the very least, it would mean grabbing Sleitman and Andy early. And if Finley Otego, the voice Sleitman reported to from the Dogon, didn't hear from these two again before the Day of the Wolves, there would be suspicions. Eddie felt movement in the hand on his arm. Susanna had just crossed her fingers. 4. "There aren't living creatures beneath the masks," Roland said. "The wolves are the undead servants of the vampires who rule Thunderclap." An awed murmur greeted this carefully crafted bit of claptrap. "They're what my friends Eddie, Susanna, and Jake call zombies. They can't be killed by bow, ba, or bullet unless struck in the brain or the heart." Roland tapped the left side of his chest for emphasis. "And of course, when they come on their raids, they come wearing heavy armor under their clothes." Henchik was nodding, Several of the other older men and women, Falcon, who well remembered the wolves coming not just once before but twice, were doing the same.
"It explains a good deal," he said. "But how—"
"To strike them in the brain is beyond our abilities, because of the helmets they wear under their hoods," Roland said. "But we saw such creatures in Ludd. Their weakness is here." Again he tapped his chest. "The undead don't breathe, but there's a kind of gill above their hearts. If they armor it over, they die. That's where we'll strike them." A low, considering hum of conversation greeted this, and then Grandpere's voice, shrill and excited,
"'Tis ever word true for Dinna Molly Doolin strike on their cell with a dish, and not even dead on either, and yet the creature dropped down."
Susanna's hand tightened on Eddie's arm enough for him to feel her short nails, but when he looked at her, she was grinning in spite of herself. He saw a similar expression on Jake's face.
"Trig enough when the chips were down, old man," Eddie thought. "Sorry I ever doubted you. Let Andy and Sleipman go back across the river and report that happy horseshit."
He'd asked Roland if they, the faceless they represented by someone who called himself Finley Otago, would believe such tripe. "They've raided this side of the Hwy for over 100 years and lost but a single fighter," Roland had replied. "I think they'd believe anything. At this point, their really vulnerable spot is their complacence."
"Bring your twins here by 7 o'clock on Wolf's Eve," Roland said. "There'll be ladies, sisters of Oriza, you ken, with lists on slate boards. They'll scratch off each pair as they come in. It's my hope to have a line drawn through every name before 9 o'clock.
"Ye'll not drag no line through the names of mine,"
cried an angry voice from the back of the crowd. The voice's owner pushed several people aside and stepped forward next to Jake. He was a squat man with a small-holed rice patch far to the southwards. Roland scratched through the untidy storehouse of his recent memory, untidy, yes, but nothing was ever thrown away, and eventually came up with the name, Neil Faraday, one of the few who hadn't been home when Roland and his quartet had come calling. Or not home to them, at least. A hard worker, according to Tian, but an even harder drinker. He certainly looked the part. There were dark circles under his eyes, and a complication of burst purplish veins on each cheek. Scruffy, say big, big. Yet Telford and Took threw him a grateful, surprised look. "Another sane man in Bedlam," it said. "Thank the gods."
"They'll take in babbies any row, and burn in Squabbit Town flat," he said, speaking in an accent that made his words almost incomprehensible. "But they'll have one each of my, see, and that'll steal me 3, and a best. They ain't worth Squabbit, but my Hogan is."
Faraday looked around at the townsfolk with an expression of sardonic disdain.
"Burn ye flat and be damned to ye," he said. "Num gits."
And back into the crowd he went, leaving a surprising number of people looking shaken and thoughtful. He had done more to turn the momentum of the crowd with his contemptuous and, to Eddie at least, incomprehensible tirade than Telford and Took had been able to do together.
"He may be shirt-tail poor, but I doubt if he'll have trouble getting credit from Took for the next year or so," Eddie thought. "If the store still stands, that is."
"Cy Faraday's got a right to his opinion. But I hope he'll change it over the next few days," Roland said. "I hope you folks will help him change it, because if he doesn't, he's apt to be left not with 3 kiddies, but none at all." He raised his voice and shaped it toward the place where Faraday stood, glowering. "Then he can see how he likes working his tillage with no help but 2 mules and a wife." Telford stepped forward to the edge of the stage, his face red with fury.
"Is there nothing you won't say to win your argument, you chary man? Is there no lie you won't tell?"
"I don't lie. And I don't say for certain," Roland replied. "If I've given anyone the idea that I know all the answers, when less than a season ago I didn't even know the wolves existed, I cry your pardon. But let me tell you a story before I bid you good night. When I was a boy in Gilead, before the coming of the good man and the great burning that followed, there was a tree farm out to the east of Barony."
"Whoever heard of farming trees?"
someone called derisively. Roland smiled and nodded. Perhaps not ordinary trees, or even ironwoods, but these were Blossies, a wonderful light wood, yet strong. The best wood for boats that ever was, a piece cut thin nearly floats in the air. They grew over 1,000 acres of land, tens of thousands of blosswood trees in neat rows, all overseen by the barony forester. And the rule, never even bent, let alone broken, was this. Take 2, plant 3.
Aye, Eisenhart said, 'tis much the same with stock, and with threaded stock the advice is to keep 4 for every 1 you sell or kill. Not that many could afford to do so.
Roland's eyes roamed the crowd. During the summer season I turned 10, a plague fell on the Blosswood Forest. Spiders spun white webs over the upper branches of some, and those trees died from their tops down, rotting as they went, falling of their own weight long before the plague could get to the roots. The forester saw what was happening, and ordered all the good trees cut down at once, to save the wood while it was still worth saving, do you see? There was no more take 2 and plant 3, because the rule no longer made any sense. The following summer, the Blossy Woods east of Gilead was gone. Utter silence from the Falcon. The day had drained down to a premature dusk. The torches hissed. Not an eye stirred from the gunslinger's face. Here in the Kala, the wolves harvest babies, and needn't even go to the work of planting them, because, hear me, that's the way it is with men and women. Even the children know. Daddy's no fool when he plants the rice kamala, mommy knows just what to do. A murmur from the Falcon. The wolves take, then wait. Take, and wait. It's worked fine for them, because men and women always plant new babies, no matter what else befalls. But now comes a new thing. Now comes plague. Took began.
Aye, say true, you're a plague, or a—
Then someone knocked the hat off his head. Eben Took whirled, looked for the culprit, and saw 50 unfriendly faces. He snatched up his hat, held it to his breast, and said no more. If they see the baby farming is over for them here, Roland said, this last time they won't just take twins. This time they'll take every child they can get their hands on while the taking's good. So bring your little ones at 7 o'clock. That's my best advice to you.
What choice have you left them?
Telford asked. He was white with fear and fury. Roland had had enough of him. His voice rose to a shout, and Telford fell back from the force of his suddenly blazing blue eyes. None that you have to worry about, Si, for your children are grown, as everyone in town knows. You've had your say. Now why don't you shut up? A thunder of applause and boot-stomping greeted this. Telford took the bellowing and jeering for as long as he could, his head lowered between his hunched shoulders like a bull about to charge. Then he turned and began shoving his way through the crowd. Took followed. A few moments later they were gone. Not long after that the meeting ended. There was no vote. Roland had given them nothing to vote on. No, Eddie thought again as he pushed Susanna's chair toward the refreshments. Cozy really wasn't in it at all. 5. Not long after, Roland accosted Ben Sleitman. The foreman was standing beneath one of the torch poles, balancing a cup of coffee and a plate with a piece of cake on it. Roland also had cake and coffee. Across the greensward, the children's tent had for the nonce become the refreshment tent. A long line of waiting people snaked out of it. There was low talk, but little laughter. Closer by, Benny and Jake were tossing a spring ball back and forth, every now and then letting Oi have a turn. The bumbler was barking happily, but the boys seemed as subdued as the people waiting in line.
"He spoke well tonight," Sleitman said, and clicked his coffee cup against Roland's.
"Do you say so?"
"Aye. Of course they were ready, as I think you knew, but Faraday must have been a surprise to you, and you handled him well."
"I only told the truth," Roland said. "If the wolves lose enough of their troop, they'll take what they can and cut their losses." Legends grow beards, and 23 years is plenty of time to grow a long one. Kala Fokin assume there are thousands of wolves over there in Thunderclap, maybe millions of them, but I don't think that's true. Sleipman was looking at him with frank fascination.
Why not?
Because things are running down, Roland said simply. And then, I need you to promise me something. Sleipman looked at him warily. The lenses of his spectacles twinkled in the torchlight.
If I can, Roland, I will.
Make sure your boy's here 4 nights from now. His sister's dead, but I doubt if that untwins him to the wolves. He's still very likely got what it is they come for. Sleipman made no effort to disguise his relief.
Aye, he'll be here. I never considered Otten else.
Good. And I have a job for you, if you'll do it. The wary look returned.
What job would it be?
I started off thinking that 6 would be enough to mind the children while we dealt with the wolves, and then Rosalita asked me what I'd do if they got frightened and panicked.
Ah, but you'll have him in a cave, won't you?
Sleipman asked, lowering his voice. Kitties can't run far in a cave, even if they do take fright. Far enough to run into a wall and brain themselves, or fall down a hole in the dark. If one were to start a stampede on account of the yelling and the smoke and the fire, they might all fall down a hole in the dark. I've decided I'd like to have an even 10 watching the kiddos. I'd like you to be one of them.
Roland, I'm flattered.
Is that a yes? Sleipman nodded. Roland eyed him. You know that if we lose, the ones minding the children are apt to die.
If I thought you were going to lose, I'd never agree to go out there with the kids.
He paused.
Or send my own.
Thank you, Ben. Thee's a good man. Sleipman lowered his voice even further.
Which of the mines is it going to be? The Gloria or the Redbird?
And when Roland didn't answer immediately,
Of course I understand if you'd rather not tell.
It's not that, Roland said. It's that we haven't decided.
But it'll be one or the other.
Oh, aye, where else? Roland said absently, and began to roll a smoke.
And you'll try to get above them.
Wouldn't work, Roland said. Angle's wrong. He patted his chest above his heart. Have to hit him here, remember. Other places no good. Even a bullet that goes through armor wouldn't do much damage to a zombie.
It's a problem, isn't it?
It's an opportunity, Roland corrected. You know the scree that spreads out below the adits of those old garnet mines? Looks like a baby's bib.
Aye?
We'll hide ourselves in there, under there. And when they ride toward us, we'll rise up and... Roland cocked a thumb and forefinger at Sleipman and made a trigger-pulling gesture. A smile spread over the foreman's face.
Roland, that's brilliant.
No, Roland contradicted, only simple. But simple's usually best. I think we'll surprise them. Hem them in and pick them off. It's worked for me before. No reason it shouldn't work again.
No, I suppose not.
Roland looked around. Best we not talk about such things here, Ben. I know you're safe, but... Ben nodded rapidly.
Say no more, Roland. I understand.
The spring ball rolled to Sleitman's feet. His son held up his hands for it, smiling.
Pa, throw it!
Ben did, and hard. The ball sailed, just as Molly's plate had in Grandpere's story. Benny leaped, caught it one-handed, and laughed. His father grinned at him fondly, then glanced at Roland.
They's a pair, ain't they? Yours and mine?
Aye, Roland said, almost smiling. Almost like brothers, sure enough. 6. The quartet ambled back toward the rectory, riding 4 abreast, feeling every town eye that watched them go, death on horseback.
You happy with how it went, sugar?
Susanna asked Roland. It'll do, he allowed, and began to roll a smoke.
I'd like to try one of those,
Jake said suddenly. Susanna gave him a look both shocked and amused.
Bite your tongue, sugar. You haven't seen 13 yet. My dad started when he was 10. "'Hannah be dead by 50, like as not,' Susanna said sternly. "'No great loss,' Jake muttered. But he let the subject drop.
"'What about Mia?' Roland asked, popping a match with his thumbnail. "'Is she quiet?'
"'If it wasn't for you boys, I'm not sure I'd believe there even was such a Jane.'
"'And your belly's quiet, too?'
"'Yes.'
Susanna guessed everyone had rules about lying. Hers was that if you were going to tell one, you did best to keep it short. If she had a chap in her belly, some sort of monster, she'd let them help her worry about it a week from tonight, if they were still able to worry about anything, that was. For the time being, they didn't need to know about the few little cramps she'd been having.
"Then all's well," the gunslinger said.
They rode in silence for a while, and then he said, "I hope you two boys can dig. There'll be some digging to do."
"Graves?"
Eddie asked, not sure if he was joking or not.
"Graves come later." Roland looked up at the sky, but the clouds had advanced out of the west and stolen the stars. "Just remember, it's the winners who dig them."